Welcome to Clinical Corner. I'm your host, Leslie Kaminoff, and I've been a yoga educator since 1979. And most of that time, I've had the privilege of learning from working with individuals. In each episode of this podcast, I'll chat with other clinicians about the history, techniques, and stories related to the healing work they do with their clients. The premium version of this episode, in which my guest and I review and analyze a video recording of them working with a client in a private session, is available by subscription at breathingproject.com. Now, let's get to our episode. Welcome to the very first episode of Clinical Corner, in which I speak with Libby Hinesley. Libby is a doctor of physical therapy and certified yoga therapist who's been teaching since 2005 and training yoga teachers and practicing physical therapy since 2011. Like myself, Libby draws most of her inspiration from the tradition of Desikachar and Krishnamacharya. She studied at the Yoga Mandiram in Chennai in 2008. I first met Libby when I was teaching a workshop in her hometown of Asheville, North Carolina, where she practices, specializing in treating people with hypermobility syndromes, chronic pain, and yoga-related injuries. So let's get right to the chat that I had with the wonderful Libby Hinesley, author of the brand new book, Yoga for Bendy People. Okay. Recording is in progress. Hi, Libby.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Yes, I'm happy that you're here too. This is the first recording I'm doing for this new podcast, just so you know. And You're one of the first people I thought of talking to, because the last time we had a lengthy chat about this very topic, in the back of my head, as we were talking about all of this stuff that you specialize in, it was like, other people need to know this information. This would be a great conversation to share. And so now we get a chance to do it. And so congratulations on being the premier guest on this new podcast, which I'm calling Clinical Corner.
That's awesome. That makes it even double special to be here.
Okay. And as I said in the email that I sent, this, what I'm aiming for here is the opposite of dumbing things down, because we're aiming at people like us as our audience, people who work one-on-one with other folks, whether as a yoga teacher, a yoga therapist, a yoga educator, or just a movement person in general, because I think there's a very wide swath of interest in the sort of things that we'll be talking about. And so we can really kind of get into the nitty-gritty and talk shop a little bit, which is going to be fun.
Great.
Yeah. So why don't you just introduce yourself and just tell people a little bit about how you came to do what you do and have this particular focus.
Okay. Well, I'm Libby Hinesley, and I am I've been a yoga teacher since 2005. And in my first, early years of teaching yoga, of course, I got really interested in people's quick questions after class that they always have, such as like, why is my shoulder hurt? Why is my hip hurt? And I was like, I have no idea, but I'm interested in that stuff. And so that all led me into go to physical therapy school. So I've been practicing as a physical therapist for about 10 years and training teachers for about that same amount of time as well. So in the background of all that, of course, was just my life. And in my life, especially in my yoga practicing life, I had chronic pain and injury going on sort of in the background, and had all the classic sort of yoga related injuries that so many yoga practitioners have. And I had a long history before that too of shoulder injuries, especially rotator cuff injuries. I was a competitive tennis player for a long time. So anyway, I had crazy shoulders, sacroiliac joint pain, hip pain, knee pain, foot pain, sort of like all pretty much head to toe pain. But especially
a young person should be having. Right?
Definitely. In fact, the decade that I had the most pain was my 20s.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was the decade I got more heavily into yoga practice. And unfortunately, I was drawn to types of asana practice that were not right for me at all. I mean, and there's nothing necessarily categorically wrong with any style of asana, but the question is it the right one for this practitioner? And for this practitioner, what I was doing was not the right practice. So
well, that's an interesting thing, because people get drawn to things based on what they're sort of already able to do to some extent. And that can end up being exactly the opposite of what you need, because it's going to exacerbate some of the imbalances that you may already have in your system.
Yes. Well, exactly. I think we're drawn to the things that probably feed our existing dysfunctions initially anyway. And so that's what I was moving really quickly and, lots. It's just kind of Ashtanga vinyasa style, fast paced, hot stuff, right, stretching as far as possible. And so I didn't really have a great understanding of my joint hypermobility at that time, but over the years, especially as I got into physical therapy, and even more so when I started treating injured yoga practitioners, which is primarily who I see at this point as a yoga therapist, PT, within my private practice. And they all had the same stuff. And it turns out they all had the same stuff I had always had too. And, luckily for me, my chronic yoga pain and injury, nagging aches and pains, the sacroiliac joint, the high hamstring strain. I mean, I had those for 10 years, every single day for 10 years. And that started to turn around when I got into a different way of practicing asana, which is when I discovered the Vinnyasa yoga lineage. And that was in 2008 when I went to study at Desikachar's place in Chennai, India for a month. I did their immersion and it just changed everything for me.
How did you first hear about that? I'm always interested in sort of the entry point for that, because it back then it was a little more obscure than it is now.
Well, I had no idea what I was getting into at all. Really? When I signed up. I had no clue. I just had read a couple of Desikachar's books. Oh. In my teacher training, my initial training in 2004, and I really loved his books. And so I looked into it and I thought, this place sounds awesome. I was considering going to physical therapy school and I was reading about kind of how they deal with one-on-one clients and assessments. And I thought, ooh, this is like a really neat, well, it was yoga therapy, right? And that's not the training I took there, but I just was interested in what they were doing at the center. And so when I showed up there, honestly, that first week or so of the month-long immersion, I hated it.
Because coming from your background as an athlete and very active style of practice, mm-hmm. I can see how that would be kind of a shock to the system, the way they practice there.
It was a real shock to the system. I was like, what are we doing? This is so boring.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh. And, so there was that initial reaction, but then about a week into it, I discovered, wow, something magical is happening here in my body, in my breath. I've never experienced asana this way at all. And it turns out I totally fell in love with it.
Hmm. And you weren't in pain after practicing, I would guess.
That's the thing, is that my body, everything changed for my physical injuries and pain related to asana practice. And those things haven't really bothered me since. I mean, it took me a while to really integrate the new ways of practicing and to really change my habits in yoga. And even when I would go to attend a class, making those modifications that I needed, that took a while to do. But once I did, they just haven't bothered me since. And then a lot of other things happened in my life, like strength training and things like that, that have really supported my body too. So that's how I got into that lineage of yoga and just been interested in it ever since.
Now, you did the PT training after you studied at the KYM.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious if, as part of your education to become a physical therapist, this whole issue of hypermobility was covered as a topic.
Well, it's really interesting that you ask, because it really wasn't. In fact, so a couple of years ago, I was finally diagnosed with hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, hypermobile EDS. And when I learned about EDS and hypermobility syndromes in general in PT school, I would have never in a million years thought I could have something like that.
Really? Have you sitting in class doing this with your thumb to see if...
I did. And honestly, I was always like the weird example in PT school of everything, and the professors would be like, this isn't normal for an adult. And, you know, but that's kind of as far as it went. And when it got into really kind of talking about more pathologies, I had in my mind that someone with EDS basically couldn't walk without a mobility aid, or they would be dislocating every joint all the time. That's sort of like, I had that really extreme view in my mind. That's not the case at all, of course. And people who have hypermobility syndromes are all over a spectrum of impairments and disabilities, but I never really got a clear picture of what it meant to have a hypermobility syndrome, and neither does anyone probably who goes through PT school or, you know, physician training. And that is one of the biggest problems for this conversation.
And that's what I wanted to focus on here, because as yoga teacher, educator, therapists, however we designate ourselves, we are really on the front line of being able to spot this and recognize it for people, because it is so often overlooked in the medical realm. And I know personally, from workshops and other things that I've taught, having been able to spot people and say, hey, have you heard of hypermobility, Ehlers-Danlos, whatever? And people are like, no. And then, you know, you say just a little bit about it, and all of a sudden a light bulb goes off and their entire life starts making sense.
Exactly.
This is coming from a non-medical person. This is coming from just someone that's in the front of rooms where groups of people are moving, and you can spot right away when something stands out as being beyond the range of what normal range of motion should look like.
Right. It's true. I mean, there's so much to that, because the problem is so many yoga teachers don't know what normal human movement should look like. You know, just because they don't have a lot of training in that, and because they're used to looking at people who move more than normal, you know, because I think yoga, you know, hypermobility is so overrepresented in yoga populations. So yoga teachers start to think that it's normal to move that way. So they're looking out at a room, and the very bendy ones they think are the normal ones, and the normal ones they think are the tight ones, you know.
Well, I've never personally thought that, but that's only because I started off with a background in things like biomechanics and sports medicine, and just a little bit more of an anatomical basis to what I was seeing. But in a typical class where people are involved in what I tend to call the unbridled pursuit of unlimited flexibility, then you're like a star pupil, and you're often demonstrated on or with, you become the teacher's personal Gumby toy, and a lot of injury can happen that way.
It's true. It's true. And so I agree that yoga teachers are in a unique position to recognize things and to help people understand their bodies better. And there's like a fine sort of needle to thread, I guess, in that, which is to not be alarmist about it. I mean, I think that's one thing to kind of bring out in our conversation is, it's okay if someone has hypermobility. They're not going to literally fall apart on their yoga mat. And I think a lot of people have so much concern that they're going to break and that they're highly fragile and this type of thing. I think we need to temper that, but also recognize that this can be the thing that helps someone make sense of their entire life. So, and that was the case for me too. It is the unifying principle, basically, of all the things in my life that I never thought were related. Because we're not just talking about bendy joints and all the musculoskeletal fallout that happens from that. We're also talking about, I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, I want to get into that, because there is a long laundry list of things that, and we just, in our previous conversation, we discussed this, that clusters around this diagnosis. And we'll get to that in a minute, but I'm just curious, do you recall, was there a single moment when the light bulb went off? I mean, was it a sudden revelation when it all kind of came together and you were like, oh, wow, this explains my life?
Well, it was the moment I got the diagnosis.
Right.
But leading up to that, it was several years of progressive sort of dawning realizations, both being around a good friend of mine who has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and we were teaching together on chronic pain. And right. that's another area that I specialize in, the neuroscience of pain. Right. And those often are the same, the chronic pain and the hypermobility people are usually very commonly the same people. And so I was learning a lot just in my clinical practice. Uh-huh. That just kept on sounding so familiar, you know, like, oh, that sounds a lot like me. And I just kind of kept connecting these different dots. And it was after the birth of my second child in 2016 that my health really fell apart in a bigger way. And I'd always had all kinds of chronic weird stuff. But it was not until then that things really came apart and I started having more serious symptoms, cardiac symptoms and digestive problems and more pronounced, you know, multi-system involvement. And that's when I started seeking medical stuff. I went through the whole gamut that people always go through. I saw all the specialists. I got gaslit repeatedly, just like every, you know, this medical kind of gaslighting that happens when physicians don't understand what's going on and they don't know about the condition. And so they're very dismissive. Mm. And it's not intentional to be dismissive, but that's what happens to people. And so I went through all that.
So you go through your entire training as a physical therapist and the clinical work you do there, you go through a whole range of medical exams and, you know, specialists, mm-hmm. and it's still not coming together for anyone to say, hey, we know what this is.
Yeah.
So who finally figures it out?
A geneticist. So I finally, I downloaded the diagnostic criteria for hypermobile EDS, which is a clinical diagnosis. Yeah. You know, we can talk about EDS a bit more, but it's the only one of 14 subtypes that doesn't actually have a blood test to confirm it. It is made by a clinical diagnosis, a checklist of attributes. And I downloaded that.
And this and this symptoms or yeah. histories or whatever.
Exactly.
Then it qualifies, but it's not like they're running a blood test or checking your DNA or, you know.
That's right.
Not a lab test.
Exactly. Unless they need to rule out a different type of EDS, because all the other 13 types do have a blood test, a molecular marker associated with them. So you could, you know, rule those out.
Right.
To be as part of the confirmation if they thought that was necessary. But there's research underway to try to determine what is the genetic cause. Like, could we pinpoint it and do a blood test for it? That is underway. It's not well understood for hypermobile EDS. And some of the reasoning for that or the hypotheses for that is that it's complicated, that there's a lot going on, that it's not just one easily explained genetic alteration, but it's a whole host of them. It has to do with collagen. It might have to do with collagen producing cells, their behavior, the fibroblast behavior, and their inability to contract, to create tension across the tissue. It may have to do even with the genes that regulate inflammation. So it's just more complex.
So you can go with whatever genetic predisposition leads to it and never develop it, because exactly. there's so many factors that can cause the expression of these genes in your life. And yeah. It's complicated. And you can have EDS and not be hypermobile.
Well, yes. Or you could have EDS. Yeah. It's so, this is just like, it's a tangled ball of yarn. You know, and some people even with EDS don't appear hypermobile because they may have so much compensating muscle tension that their flexibility is really limited.
And that's what fascinated me in our first conversation, is because someone who actually has hypermobile EDS will not necessarily self-identify as being flexible. They feel the tightness that they're using in their yeah. nervous system, in their musculature, to literally hold their joints together.
Yeah, exactly. They feel tight, and they are tight sometimes, yeah. and they can't touch their toes. Mm-hmm. And so there's all kinds of problems with the standard sort of hypermobility assessments that we use, because they don't
They don't screen for that. You could be completely bound up around your loose connective tissue and not exhibit excessive range of motion, but you still have it.
Exactly. And sometimes you can tease that out through passive versus active range of motion. But so all of that is to say, you know, the hypermobile EDS diagnosis is clinical. And so in my sort of story of my coming to this realization, I just downloaded it. I tested myself. I looked up what all the things are. I looked at my body. I did all the things. I was like, oh, looks like I have this. And so I took it to my primary care doctor, who is wonderful, but she doesn't know about it. Uh-huh. But she said, hey, looks like you found something here. I'm going to refer you to the geneticist. And that's often the pass off is to a geneticist who knows all about it. And so I had that visit with him and I write about it in the book. And he said, yeah, this basically sounds like a classic case of hypermobile EDS, you know, and I was just like, and that was the moment I was like, the relief and the validation was really surprising. Honestly, I didn't really expect it to be that powerful.
Really? And this is for someone with a heavy duty clinical background and education.
Exactly.
And I'm thinking of people that have none of that, who are suffering with this their entire lives. And what a profound life-altering realization it can be when they're finally handed an explanation for everything, not only what they've been experiencing, but it tends to run in families, does it not? I mean, you have to look at the family history and, you know, relatives who have similar body types and symptoms.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And there's always, even for someone like me who had studied it a lot, studied chronic pain a lot, and, you know, see people with hypermobility clinically all the time, there's always that just nagging thing like, well, maybe what I'm experiencing is normal. Maybe this isn't that big of a deal. And there's always that little bit of self-doubt. And what's interesting is that I think that's even more common in people who have hypermobility, because they have a hard time knowing how they feel and getting clear about, like, literally physiologically how they feel, and kind of establishing a clear boundary about where their stuff ends and somebody else's stuff begins. So they're kind of impressionable, I have to say. And it's kind of weird, but there's an issue with boundaries there that's really more physiological than anything. I don't want to paint it as like a psychological defect, but it really is inherent in the difficulty with proprioception and interoception.
Well, that's a great segue, because that's on that list of all these associated issues that go along with it. So there's difficulty with proprioception, meaning the actual mechanisms, the physical mechanisms, the mechanoreceptors that live in the connective tissue that deliver information to your nervous system about where your joints are in space, are affected by this. Mm-hmm. And so you don't have that information being delivered to your nervous system.
Exactly. Those mechanoreceptors aren't stimulated as easily because the connective tissue is floppy and it needs to sense tension for that stimulus or something. It's got to sense some sort of mechanical event, some mechanical reality. That's what those sensors are looking for. And they don't get the information until you get to your end range. And that is what's so tricky. A hypermobile person can't really feel anything without, you know, some training. I mean, we can learn, but it's hard to feel anything about where we are in space unless we're at an end range. And then those mechanoreceptors, finally there's tension across the tissue. Finally, they're stimulated and they're like, here we are. You have a body. Here it is. But before you get there, you're just like, I don't know where I am. And it's really hard to feel embodied.
But that's a catch-22, isn't it? Because to get that sense of where your joints are, you're actually putting yourself in a range of motion that's going to not help your problem and possibly make it worse because you're at your end range.
Exactly. So especially for people who subluxate or dislocate, that's where it's going to happen. You know, and people who have strains and sprains, that's where it's going to happen. And so it is problematic. And the trick is, backing way up and learning how to sense. I mean, that's really the project with hypermobile people, is teaching them how to sense their bodies in a new way that is far more subtle than anything they've experienced.
Yeah. And we're going to get to that, the actual clinical application of some of this information in the second half of our talk, which, by the way, will be available to subscribers to the platform that we're putting this. I see that's the little carrot at the end of the stick there. It's like, how do you put this in practice? And we're actually go to the mat and show some of this stuff, which is really important. And I just had to figure this out on my own without knowing this information years and years ago when I had hypermobile people in class. And I was like, okay, so you can go there, great. What happens if you pull back and work at something that doesn't feel like an end range? It's really, really difficult, you know?
It is so difficult.
And actually, I was always telling the story about how, well, the stiff people like me have it easy. You know, we're going to hit our end range all the time. And it's like, okay, I'm going to develop some skills around dealing with that, like holding, releasing, breathing. And so the boundaries that I'm hitting up against are very clear. And then I develop skills of working with those boundaries. But establishing a boundary that your body isn't telling you should be there, that you're choosing to respect, is much more difficult, both physically, because you're having to engage so much muscle effort to keep your joints from seeking that end range, but also it's emotionally challenging. Mm-hmm. To say, okay, I'm just going to stop here because I'm choosing to stop here and work at this place. Yeah. And it's tough. I've seen people really struggle with it, but it's so necessary. So what else is on this rather long laundry list of difficulties that people have when they have? Now, by the way, can we add to this, to the Ehlers-Danlos hypermobility, things like Marfan syndrome, which also affect connective tissue stability? It's a somewhat related diagnosis, isn't it?
Yes, there are a number of conditions that feature hypermobility as one, you know, of the aspects. And Marfan syndrome is one of them, and their osteogenesis imperfecta would be another one. And Ehlers-Danlos are 14 types. So I would say the most common of the big umbrella of hypermobility syndromes would be the EDS syndrome, the Ehlers-Danlos syndromes, multiple of them. But the one that is most common within that is the hypermobile type. And it's confusing that it's called that, because all the types of EDS generally feature joint hypermobility. But most of them are more rare. Some of them are ultra rare. And the hypermobile type is not rare, but its prevalence is hard to determine because it's so often not diagnosed or it's misdiagnosed. And there's a sister diagnosis I want to mention too, just to confuse things a little bit more, which is hypermobility spectrum disorder. Okay, so let's go back to that checklist I was talking about with EDS, the hypermobile EDS diagnostic criteria. Let's say somebody has what I call symptomatic hypermobility. Okay. They have joint hypermobility and they have symptoms related to it. They've got pain, joint pain, dislocation, subluxations, chronic fatigue. They've got all kinds of mental health, digestive, all the things we'll talk about in a second, but they don't meet those criteria. Well, that's when someone will be diagnosed with hypermobility spectrum disorder. Hmm. And the thing is that is not a lesser diagnosis than hypermobile EDS. It is simply a different diagnosis. Hmm. And that's what I want to emphasize for people interested in this, because that's not well understood by anyone, even, you know, in the medical field or elsewhere, that the hypermobile EDS diagnostic criteria really was developed to support genetic research. Right. And so it wants to isolate, and we're looking for the genetics here.
You're in our study or you're not, based on these criteria, so that we understand the genetics behind it.
Exactly.
It doesn't mean that you're suffering less from it or that the treatment is necessarily going to be very different to help you, but it's either you're in this sort of genetic pool that we want to understand or you're not.
Exactly. So it's sort of like genotype versus phenotype in a way. Mm-hmm. Here's the hypermobile EDS and here's something that looks just like it. And experts in the field, they just put it all together. And that is one lump thing. And clinically, you treat it exactly the same. And those people are basically this. I don't differentiate between those two diagnoses clinically at all. And so that's something to be aware of, because a lot of people say, well, I've just got hypermobility spectrum disorder. It's not like I have EDS, you know? And so it's just assumed that like EDS is really scary and really severe. And it isn't always. I mean, I have it, you know, and I'm a pretty high functioning person.
Well, what about your kids? Are you, you know, concerned about, are you testing mm-hmm. their joints just to make sure they're, you know, not exhibiting the same tendencies as their mom?
They definitely are. I mean, especially my younger child, she's super Gumby. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. She was kind of, you know, she was never behind in motor development. She got diagnosed with mild hypotonia as a baby, but that's probably not the right diagnosis. She was just floppy because her joints are floppy. You know, it wasn't a muscular problem. It was just, she was a little bit floppy, but she's actually very athletic. And very physical, but she definitely has what I have, you know, and the older daughter is hard to say. She doesn't exhibit it as much. So
how fortunate that she'll be able to grow up understanding this from the get-go.
Yeah.
From your experience.
Exactly.
Avoid yeah. some of the pitfalls that you fell into.
Yeah. And that's one of the motivating factors for me to get that diagnosis made official, was so that, you know, if my kids have issues down there, they don't have to jump through hoops or wonder for 20 plus years, you know, that I was seeking and wondering what is going on with my body. Why is it like this? Really, since I was about 20. So then I'm 45 now. So they won't have to do that. They'll skip that.
That's great. And that's why this is all about the education, you know, getting this information out there. And that is why I am so excited that your book is soon to hit the shelves, isn't it?
It is. So it'll be hitting the shelves at the very end of May or early June 2022. So it's in layout now. It's pretty much finished, on its way.
And it's got a nice blurb, I think, that I wrote for it.
It does. It'll be on the back cover.
Woo-hoo. Yeah. And the book is called
Yoga for Bendy People.
Of course it is. And that's the perfect title.
Yeah. And so in the book, the first part is a bunch of background, all the stuff we're talking about laid out, you know, so that people really can understand what is hypermobility by itself. And then what is hypermobility syndrome? Yeah. Because, you know, someone can be hypermobile and be just fine. Mm-hmm. So it's not the case that if you see someone in your class and they're very, you know, they've got a lot of range of motion, we can't jump to a conclusion that there's something like wrong with them. You know, we don't want to pathologize that, but because hypermobility can be caused by a number of things, but a lot of people who have hypermobility is caused by an underlying genetic difference that affects their connective tissue. And that's when it's more likely to be symptomatic. And so the book goes through all of that background, even goes into a chapter on connective tissue nitty gritty to get really understand tissue mechanics. And how is the bendy person's connective tissue different? Mm-hmm. It is different stuff. And to help understand what's underlying that, and paint a big picture. And then, of course, I get into, you know, some suggestions for how to approach a yoga practice that is supportive for this person, not only that avoids injury, because that's something we want to do, but it's far more interesting to me to talk about how can yoga actually help them.
Well, like the shift you experienced at the KYM, all of a sudden there's a way of thinking about what I'm doing in my practice that on the one hand isn't going to exacerbate, you know, my situation, but will actually promote more health, more integration, and overall just more clarity on what I'm actually trying to accomplish with a practice. Did you have, when you were writing, I'm curious, did you have mostly yoga practitioners in mind or yoga teachers, or was it both? Is the audience pretty much both of those?
Yep, pretty much both of those. And that was, you know, early on, one of my editors was like, you have to choose an audience. You know, it's either you need to dumb it way down for the yoga practitioner, or it's good as it is for the yoga teacher. And I was like, we're going to go with it. I'm going to try to explain everything in as accessible way as I can. But here's the thing about people with hypermobility syndromes, even if they're not yoga teachers, they need to become experts at their condition anyway. And so this is a particular population where I'm okay challenging them a little bit if they're challenged by it, because their doctor doesn't know what they will know after reading this book for the most part.
Yeah. And that's a pretty remarkable statement. Considering, yeah. Okay, let's get into some numbers now. What percentage of the general population is it estimated has this or these kinds of issues?
Up to 20% is like the highest estimate that I've seen. And again, the prevalence is very hard to pinpoint. But when you lump together hypermobile EDS with hypermobility spectrum disorder, it is thought to be, you know, 10 to 20% of people. And now that's general population. So let's take yoga practicing population.
I was going to say that what percentage of people that show up to a yoga class are going to have this? Higher.
And then what percentage of people are going to feel so successful at yoga that they decide to become yoga teachers?
Yeah. Just scan through Instagram and make your estimate based on what you see there from the, you know, the yoga images.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who are actually getting, if not full-blown careers, are getting a lot of positive feedback for the extreme things their bodies can do. Who are always looking for the next most extreme thing they can photograph and put up there and get more followers. You know, it's like we're in this sort of echo chamber that really can exacerbate people's tendencies to push themselves in ways that are not necessarily healthy.
It really can. And unfortunately, it doesn't just do that, but it also intimidates all these would-be practitioners, right? Like for whom yoga is awesome and could really be great for their life. And then they feel like they're not flexible enough because they see all this imagery. So it does both of those things. Both of those are damaging. So yeah, the book is really, I would say, primarily targeted to teachers, but absolutely appropriate for practitioners who think they might be bendy.
Yeah. Well, as I think I said in the blurb, should be required reading for every teacher training program, for sure. Okay, so 20% of the population, certainly higher than that in yoga environments. So some of the other thing, and I was fascinated to learn some of this, which I hadn't heard before in our previous conversation. Let's just go through the list of difficulties people have that are associated with this, and certainly mechanical, physiological, emotional, nervous system. So just kind of rattle it off for us so people can know what this affects.
Yeah. So as far as the body goes, almost universally sacroiliac joint pain. Yeah. That's the top of the list. Joint dislocations, subluxations, headaches. Mm. But beyond sort of the mechanical musculoskeletal, we've got anxiety would be the biggest one. Anxiety and panic disorders. We've got some brain anatomy differences that have been documented that help explain the prevalence of anxiety and panic disorder and a hyper aroused sympathetic nervous system. So that is like probably the biggest one. And I think one of the most relevant for yoga practice, because yoga is so potentially so great at helping people learn to manage their nervous systems. So all the fallout that comes from a hyperactive sympathetic arousal, we've got smaller parietal cortex where the somatosensory area is. So the body map that helps explain that lack of proprioception as well, not just from the mechanoreceptor side of things, but also from a actual brain body mapping perspective. We've got dysautonomia. That would be another big umbrella one. Dysautonomia just means dysfunction of the autonomic nervous system, which partially we could explain with that heightened sympathetic arousal. That's one expression of dysautonomia, really. But then there's another common one that is just dizziness. Bendy people get dizzy really easily. They have low blood pressure often, low blood volume. And so what happens in the bendy body is that their vessels are saggy. If you think about the connective tissue in this body and just think of it as saggy, think of it as floppy. Well, the blood vessels are too, because they're a little saggy. So blood pools in the lower body. And in order to get that blood to keep it pumping, we have to turn up our sympathetic nervous system and the heart rate goes way up. Mm. Right. And so there's this, because otherwise it's just, you don't get cerebral blood flow, literally, and you don't get good perfusion up here. And so you get all the brain fog and the chronic fatigue and all the things, and you don't even get good perfusion into these muscles. They call it the coat hanger pain. Okay. Mm. The neck and upper traps, they're just like on fire for people so much. And they're literally not getting good blood flow because of this, let's call it orthostatic intolerance. It's so hard to be upright because of that, the saggy vessels, the blood pooling, the low blood pressure. And then that leads to the high heart rate. And that's called orthostatic tachycardia. So POTS is a really common one. And that's relevant for yoga too, in terms of positioning. You know, in my yoga practice, I hardly ever stand up.
Yeah. Well, also, you know, it's interesting because in this, the last couple of years in the age of COVID, we're hearing a lot about this dysautonomia and the POTS as being a byproduct for many people of having had COVID and the long COVID effects. And I would imagine for someone with hypermobility who had COVID, who, you know, is getting hit with this double whammy, it's got to be really, really disruptive to just about every aspect of life.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. A lot of things that are coming out of long COVID are very reminiscent of what people deal with hypermobility syndromes, chronic fatigue, the POTS, dysautonomia, and even, I don't know about mast cell dysfunction. That's a common one too, mast cell activation disorder, where your mast cells, M-A-S-T, mast cells, they're part of your immune system, and they release histamine in response to allergens. Well, they just are releasing histamine all the time in people with mast cell activation problems. And so people break out in hives, they're itchy, they're allergic to adhesives, you know, and that's really common sometimes with heat and exercise will trigger that for people. And they're like, oh yeah, I am itchy all the time, you know, and they never knew that was part of it. So those are some things. There's a higher prevalence of all kinds of other diagnoses. So for example, people who have fibromyalgia, some studies show that up to 70% or more of people with fibromyalgia diagnosis have joint hypermobility. So that's like a real close correlation. And I think that speaks to the chronic fatigue and also the muscle pain, the chronic muscle tension that is trying to compensate for joint laxity and trying to hold you together. And also that's responding to that heightened sympathetic arousal that's always in the background. It's just always in the background and it's just like that. So fibromyalgia is a really common one. And then anxiety and panic disorder I mentioned, but also neurodevelopmental disorders like autism spectrum disorder, Tourette syndrome even, ADHD, those are all very... hypermobility is very overrepresented in those populations too.
Right. Well, the important thing to remember for brain development is that without certain kinds of stimulus at certain key stages of development, certain brain centers don't develop well or fully, you know, and if you're not, and you said the parietal region, you know, where you're processing proprioceptive information, whatever, if it's not being delivered, you're not getting that stimulation. And as you said, you can see this as differences in actual brain structure. When you look at someone's adult brain, you're like, oh, you know, like if someone never got spoken to and didn't experience language, you see their language centers wouldn't develop, you know, and it sounds like we've got a similar thing going on with this lack of feedback that people are getting from their joints. And also you mentioned interoceptive feedback as well, because it's not just your joints, it's the connective tissue that all of these sensors live in your guts and in the insides of your body. And that leads me to something else you mentioned. Talk a little bit about the historic kind of emotional, relational tendencies that people with hypermobility have in terms of they're overrepresented in trauma.
Yes.
And you said you mentioned boundaries briefly earlier, and you know, how does that feed into it?
Yeah. So it's just hard to establish boundaries. I mean, that's probably hard for anybody, but it's literally so hard to establish physical movement boundaries in this person. And the thing about kind of more emotional and relational stuff, I think all points to interoception. And so the funny thing about interoception, which is the ability to sense physiological state, mm-hmm. sort of inner sensations. And those signals are actually turned way up in the hypermobile person. So they have, it's louder. It's like the volume dial on interoception is really loud, and they're bombarded with inner sensations all the time that they have trouble understanding and differentiating and discerning and interpreting. So they call that interoceptive sensitivity. And so they become, you know, it's like a lot. They're just, it's very distracting. So they're just, they're the people who can very much feel their heartbeat very easily, loudly all the time. And they're likely to be very empathetic. I mean, in fact, there's actually some research that looks at people who can feel their heartbeat are more empathetic people. They're like more generous and more caring, things like that. It's very interesting. But if you think about interoceptive signals and you think that emotions, changing emotions are interoceptive signals, they are inner sensations, and we have a hard time understanding them and interpreting them, then it actually is easier to describe why it's hard for people to know how they feel. It's like, how do you feel about this? And like, I don't know. It's just overwhelming. I can't possibly... You know, it's just hard to really tease through those sensations. And that comes into play in relational ways for sure, because you need to really understand who you are in order to understand how to communicate who you are to someone else clearly and with kindness and all of that. So understanding who you are really is sort of the crux of yoga, I guess, one of them. And I think that's one of the big ways yoga can be so wonderful for people with hypermobility syndromes is just that, helping you to go in, discern, understand, interpret all the things so that you can be in the world, be clear about who you are, where you end and that person begins, and then have that, you know, interaction that can be more meaningful and more fulfilling and less likely to get sort of drug around by someone else's agenda, basically.
And well, then, you know, that would never happen in a yoga situation, would it? But you see, here's where like even a philosophical grounding in certain ideas becomes important, because everything you're describing from if you just look at it a little bit fuzzy, it's like, isn't that what we're aiming for? Don't we want to just merge with the universe? Don't we want to just, you know, feel the boundaries dissolving between our own individual identity and the rest of the universe? I mean, you know, you know the language that gets put out there with these kind of fuzzy-wuzzy understandings of some of the ancient philosophies. And you can see how easily someone can be drawn into a very cultish kind of a situation where whatever abuse or lack of boundaries they had in their background are just going to get re-traumatized. Mm-hmm. You see this happen so much in these cultish situations that often develop around yoga traditions.
Exactly. So it's really, it always has to come back to developing an internal locus of control, which is totally antithetical to a cult situation.
And a strong ego. Let's just say a strong ego, right?
That's true. Yep. Yeah. And, you know, as far as the trauma goes, it's sometimes, I heard someone say once that hypermobile people live as though they were raised in a war zone, even if they weren't. They have a nervous system of someone who has experienced a lot of trauma. Maybe they have, right? Maybe they haven't. Like, but their nervous system is poised to respond much more strongly to life events. So, you know, and it's all about threat detection. They are very, very
hypervigilant.
Hypervigilant.
And the wrong step, your kneecap flies off its track.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, that's, you have to be hypervigilant.
it is exhausting. So there's this hypervigilance and this constant threat detection. Mm-hmm. So whatever life events happen in the course of your life, you're more likely to have a post-traumatic kind of stress response to that, a stronger response to that.
Right. And it really does. If anyone is listening to this and your life is starting to make a lot more sense from having this information, okay, and you want to find some help and some guidance, okay, obviously we'll give people your information, how to reach out to you. Definitely read the book. Mm-hmm. But where else can people find this sort of help? And I think because it's so prevalent and it's so much out there, especially in our community, what are we doing about this? Are you going to have a specialized training program or an online course or something that you offer for educators?
I am. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, so I'm going to have an online course called, well, maybe called Yoga for Mindy People. I'm going to be filming it next month, so it's got to happen soon. But it'll go along with a book. And it'll be for yoga teachers as well as practitioners. And it'll basically have a lot more practical applications, demonstrations that I talk about in the book, but also the same background information. And there's a lot of exciting stuff going on out there in the world. If you start digging, you will find so much research that's being published about hypermobility syndromes and organizations that are working on educating medical practitioners. And one of the big organizations doing that is the Ehlers-Danlos Society. And their website is just a wealth of information. It's wonderful. There are a couple podcasts, one in particular that is focused on hypermobility. One's called the Hypermobility Happy Hour. And then another called Bendy Bodies.
Have you been on this podcast yet?
Not yet. I hope to be.
Oh, you better be.
Yeah. But I've met both of them and, in fact, interviewed both of them for my book. And the hypermobile, the Bendy Bodies is often geared towards dancers, which that's another population where they're really dealing with this. And the woman who hosts that podcast is Dr. Linda Bluestein, and she calls herself the Hypermobility MD. And so she is another person who's got a lot of information out and is doing a lot to educate folks about this. So I think we'll see more and more of it because people are really coming to a bigger understanding of it. And, you know, I'm really passionate about advocating for diagnosis so that it's more visible in the medical community, right? The more doctors who have patients with this diagnosis, the more doctors are going to be motivated to learn about this diagnosis. And then that starts to change things. So I really think, too, that diagnosis is freeing for a lot of people. It certainly was for me. I don't have to be afraid of this weird stuff. Now I get it. My body's a little different. And now I can just move on with my life and learn how to manage it. So I find that it really is freeing in a lot of ways. So anyway, there's resources out there. Those are just a few that come to mind.
Well, we'll get all those links and attach them to the podcast, obviously, so people can easily track some of this down. It's a big topic, and we've spoken about a lot of stuff. We've been talking for almost an hour, and we still have some of the clinical, practical stuff to go over. So just to wrap up this first part of our discussion, what would be your message? I mean, I've read what you've written in the book, and so a lot of it is there of what you really want people to know about this. But if someone could have said something to you in your 20s that would have saved you an enormous amount of suffering, other than saying, hey, there's this thing called Ehlers-Danlos, maybe you should look into it. What would that message be for young Libby or young whoever is hearing this to help them?
Oh gosh, I mean it's a little bit overwhelming to think about if I had known this in my 20s, how much it would have changed my life. Yeah. Basically, if I had known that my body's ability to do weird stuff was related to all the other weird stuff in my life, all the other, the food sensitivities, the constant search for like food allergies and all this stuff, you know, and that's so common. And the anxiety, and then just the feeling like I can't stand up. It's exhausting to be upright. You know, my mom used to call it wilting. I would just be wilting. And you see bendy feet, they're leaning on furniture all the time. They can't stand to be upright. And it's because of all this physiological stuff going on. It's so uncomfortable. And it would have just been so helpful to know that it makes sense why you are so uncomfortable all the time. And there are a lot of other people like you, and there's stuff you can do about it. And you're not crazy or weak or wimpy, you know, and you
it's
don't
not
even-
It's your fault. It's not, you haven't done anything wrong.
Exactly. And you don't just need to do better alignment. You know what I mean? Like this is a much bigger thing, and it gives you extra sort of superpowers too. So, you know, a lot of times just empathy, that sensitivity that people have, you know, there's some really positive parts to it, but you also have to learn to manage those too.
Okay. So superpowers, what are your superpowers other than party tricks?
Yeah. So party tricks that I don't do anymore. I do think feeling in my body, that introceptive volume comes into play when there's empathy. You know, I feel what other people are feeling too. And that is hard to differentiate what's that person feeling and what am I feeling, but it also plays in my ability to empathize and to have a connection, you know, that understanding of people. I think that helps certainly clinically. Mm. And I think just the mental processing, my mental, you know, a lot of people with hypermobility syndromes have an ability to get really hyper-focused and process a great deal of material in their mental bodies and digest it and spit it out. And so they tend to have kind of a high intellectual sort of stuff and really love that. And I can sit down and really focus for a long time. It's kind of like, you know, there's ADHD, but there's also this hyper focus, which actually might be a bit of a form of ADHD in some ways.
Or it's a little spectrumy too. I mean, you mentioned
exactly.
They have spectrum disorder diagnoses in higher percentage when they have hypermobility.
Exactly. And so there's a little bit of a spectrumy mind power sort of thing going on with a lot of people. So I would say that's where I am in the sensitivity. So I try to see those things as positive attributes, but I also recognize that those things are exhausting. And the biggest thing, you know, another thing, if someone had told me 20 years ago, you don't have to work so hard. This just doesn't have to be so hard. And you have a special system, special body, a unique system that takes in a lot of information and that processes a lot of information, and it needs a lot of rest. It just needs so much rest and integration time, and you got to manage your energy or you're just going to burn it out. Mm. And that's what happens. People just go, go, go. And they literally hit such a wall. They're laid out for days in bed. And so pacing and just bringing down the expectations of what's possible in a day, you know, is so critical, that concept of pacing.
Well, like a high performance F1 car that just needs a lot of pit stops.
Yeah, lots of pit stops. It's a great way to think of it.
Yes.
Exactly. And lots of refueling, you know?
Yeah. And the tires wear out real fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So again, there's that needle to thread, which is we don't need to handle ourselves or others with hypermobility with like fragility gloves, but we do want to encourage wise management of energy, you know, wise use of yoga practice, so that you are left with the best of yourself to bring to what actually matters in your life. Mm. And again, I think that's one of the cruxes of yoga in the modern age is just that, exactly that, is not to burn it out on the yoga mat, but actually to leave yourself more integrated so that you can meet your life even better, you know?
Beautiful.
And
So. Well, it's like that shift you described at the KYM, you know, doing less, simpler tools, working with the breath,
yep,
integrating, pulling things together,
Yep, just do less. That's a huge, it's like one of the big banners. Do less.
I know. I'm always telling people it's a really hard work sometimes to not work so hard.
Yeah, it's the hardest work. Yeah. And really, hypermobile people tend to be kind of overachieving perfectionists. It just tends to be a bit of a personality trait there that's pretty well documented out there, probably just anecdotally. But nonetheless, it's very hard to do less and to pull back, whether it's range of motion or, you know, activity expectations. And when it comes to yoga practice, it's all about changing our whole idea of what is yoga for and what is it for. And
well, if that personality type is exactly what Dr. Sarno describes in his criteria for, TMS, you know, the common sources of chronic back pain. And he has a whole theory about, you know, ischemia and all of that. And it seems like there's a big overlap in what we're talking
about. Well, that's really interesting, actually, because ischemia, there's something really to that with muscle tissue and ischemia. I mean, that's what I was describing in the coat hanger scenario. Yes. And when muscles are like that, they are ischemic and they hurt, they're acidic, and there's a painful chemical soup that builds up. And that's what some you can just plan on happening in the hypermobile body. That's what's going on all the time. And it will be going on all the time. That's the other thing I would say to a young version of myself is that this is your life. This is not just getting over this little, you know, injury right now. This is how are you going to live your entire life and manage this? This is long term. This is we're going for a sustainability. We want tools that we can use all the time from now on forever.
Yeah. And 20-year-olds are just developing their brains to the point where they can do that kind of executive function, planning for the future sort of thinking.
It's true. And if you told me that really at age 20, I might have thought, whatever.
That's what I'm saying. It's like if you tell that to a 20-year-old, they're like, what, the rest of my life? What does that mean?
Yeah. And I would have opted, honestly, just to plant my face between my knees at Ashtanga class anyway. Honestly, you know, I was just really, that's just where I was. I was really caught up in the performance of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe there's some 20-year-olds out there that are going to hear this and, you know, save themselves some of the difficulties that you discovered in your 30s when you figured this out, right?
So when I finally got diagnosed, I was in my 40s, early 40s. But, you know, when I discovered KYM and the different way of practicing, when my body started to feel better dramatically, I also started strength training was in my 30s.
Yeah. All right. Well, and you want to be able to still be moving around this planet when you're in your 50s and 60s and 70s. So.
And there's no reason that we can't.
Exactly. So speaking of that, we're going to just make the segue here. And I'm just going to remind our listeners that the premium content is about to come. And you'll see easy ways to sign up for that on the Breathing Project platform when we get all this uploaded. So we're just going to sign off now for the first part. And then here's where the premium stuff starts. So Clinical Corner.